Welcome, listeners, to Flanagan's Ecologic Podcast. This is our special father-daughter series. Hello, father.
Hello, daughter.
And today we're going to be concluding the third part of our three-part series, going back in time to some of your international tours and adventures and reminiscing on some of the good times and lessons learned you had. So today we're going to talk about the Philippines. We're going to venture to Sweden. Then we're going to go pop over to Germany and the solar tours you did there, to Spain, and then we'll conclude with Iceland. So again, listeners, thank you for joining. This is father-daughter series of the Ecologic Podcast, Energy Crash Course. My name is Sierra Flanagan, joined with my dad and the star of today's show, Ted Flanagan. So, Dad, picking up where we left off last time, let's start with the Philippines. So what was that all about? What was the context? Why did you go? And what did you learn?
Well, certainly learned a lot. And I'm thankful for my friend Russell Sturm, who was working for the International Finance Corp at the time, which is part of the World Bank Group. And you know, the World Bank grants lots of money around the world, and it also invests in lots of projects around the world. And the International Finance Corp had something called the Efficient Lighting Initiative that Russ was managing. And the idea was to go to developing countries, go to countries and to leapfrog to advanced lighting. So we had the Philippines involved, the Czech Republic, Latvia, Estonia, Chile, Argentina, South Africa. And in each case, we had funds to go in and try to accelerate transitions to more efficient lighting. And when I started in the Philippines, first off, most people in the country didn't have any electricity at all. So if we could get a very efficient light bulb into a fishing shanty instead of a 60 watt incandescent, but a 13 watt compact fluorescent, that would be a wonderful thing. So there was a big focus on rural electrification, which is what I'm also focused on now in the Solomon Islands. And then there was this business of just advancing this technology. People were using very inefficient incandescent lights when they had them. And this whole new class of compact fluorescents, which now has been all superseded by LEDs completely. But the idea was to accelerate their adoption in the Philippines. So it was a great opportunity. And Russ said to me, here's $2.5 million, make a difference. I was sort of like, now how do I do that? So we had a lot of, I won't go into all the different things, but some of my favorite aspects of the program were that we decided to make it kind of fun. And there was a comedian in the Philippines, in Manila at the time, named Michael V. And when I would get off the plane in the Philippines and get into a cab, and I would just, hey, to the cab driver, have you heard of Michael V? Oh God, that guy, everybody had the same reaction. He was just cracking up the entire country. So we hired him to be the face of our efficient lighting initiative. And all of a sudden we had Michael V, his big mug, right on buses. We had bus wraps with his face on it. We slated him into soap operas. And all the time he was promoting compact fluorescent light bulbs, but doing it in a really kind of a fun way. So we had relations. We had to create a testing center because, this is a new technology. How is it going to handle the grid in the Philippines, which was not very strong. We developed a microfinancing program with Meralco. Meralco is the big utility there. Manila Electric Rail Company, I think it's called, Electric and Rail Company. And so we just had a number of initiatives going on in the Philippines. We created an office and staffed it with Filipinos. A guy named Alexander Ablaza was especially instrumental, and he saw the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy and what it was doing in America. And he did after our project, he created the Philippines Council for an Energy Efficient Economy. So it was a great example of outside funds coming in and very judiciously working with all of the different players to try to move this project forward.
And so at the end of the day, how many light bulbs did you install? What was the total impact of this project?
I don't know. That's a great question. It would take it would require a very complex evaluation. And I've only went into some of the aspects of the program. Another aspect that would really affect this impact that you're talking about is that the utility there, Meralco, it was an investor-owned utility, privately-owned utility, and it was facing the same dilemma with energy efficiency as all U.S. utilities and utilities around the world, and that is, if you promote energy efficiency, then you lose revenues, and if you're a profit-making utility, you know, that's an anathema to you. So we brought in experts on performance-based rate making, which is, you know, a way that utilities sort of decouple their sales and their profitability. And that was a fascinating thing. And that was successful. We actually changed the utility regulation by bringing in people like David Moskowitz. He'd been the commissioner for Maine, very articulate, and others that we brought in to influence this. I would say that I'm sure that we had a major effect. I'm sure there were millions and millions of light bulbs that were installed in advance of what would have happened had the program not been there. And now, as I said, you know, now probably all those complex fluorescents are gone. They're all being replaced with LEDs that are just that next evolution, even better.
So it sounds like some real cross-stakeholder engagement from a kind of relevant figure that was known to many locals to the utility. I'm curious how you made the case to the utility. You're kind of naming a key issue with utilities and the energy efficiency and renewables transition. How did you make it within their best interest to get behind this program?
Well, that's how performance-based rate making works, is that, you know, you can actually invest in efficiency, lower your sales of kilowatt hours, and your shareholders actually get a higher return than they would have in the other way around. So it was, I like to think of these things sort of as an acupressure exercise. You know, we had, like you're right, we had Michael V, the comedian. We had the president of the utility. Now, you know, the International Finance Corps of the World Bank Group has tremendous cachet, right? I mean, so we had access to the chairman or the head of the utility. We had access to the government. We had access to the testing labs. And as Russ Sturm says in his podcast, you know, it's remarkable when you do have that name behind you, what impact you can have. So in each one of the countries that were part of the project, they were all advancing, kind of pushing things forward in different ways. But fascinating, yeah. Fascinating example of what, you know, IFC could do, really do good in the world.
And ground us in the year, the era in which this intervention took place.
Right around 1999. Yeah, right at the end of the last century. Sounds really old. So
you said that, you know, a lot of these compact fluorescent have likely been replaced by LEDs. Is there anything from that program that's worth noting or kind of lessons learned that continue on today?
Well, I think, I don't know, but in a way, you know, here I am working now on this rural electrification project in the Solomon Islands. You know, and many of these Pacific Island nations are in the same boat as the Philippines was. Everybody wants, all the rural people in the rural areas want lighting. They want the real basics. They want some refrigeration. Once you get into the urban areas, like in Manila, everybody wants air conditioning. And, you know, there was no air conditioning to speak of, and there's no insulation, all single pane windows. So, you know, a lot had to take place. A lot of transition had to take place.
And so for folks interested in rural electrification in nations around the world, what would be a take-home point? What would be your advice for them in advancing some of these initiatives?
Well, it's just such an important thing. You know, rural electrification, electrification boosts literacy. Literacy boosts awareness about reproduction and limits, you know, population growth in cases. So there's just tremendous need for that in the world. And the great thing is now these LED light bulbs, and we've talked about this on other podcasts, that, you know, these kits where you have a small photovoltaic panel, 1 foot in 1 foot square, and then that's powering LEDs and charging cell phones. So there's been, I guess the takeaway would be, there's really been advances in technologies that make rural electrification that much more effective.
Great. Awesome, Dad. Are there any other points you want to make about the Philippines before we virtually
Yes, I'll just say the Philippine people are just so wonderfully, they're so friendly. They're so musical. I had nothing but great experiences. And one of the greatest experiences of my life was when Russell Sturm and I were snorkeling off of Cebu, which is a little bit south in the Philippines. And we were underwater for a while. And we came up and a whole village had come with their dugout canoes and their outriggers. And they all wanted to sell jewelry to these people from the World Bank. But again, they're just wonderful people. Great, great times, great experiences.
Awesome. And I know that you have a podcast coming up, another podcast with Russell Sturm and maybe one of his projects, I want to say in Kenya or.
That's right. That's right. We just scheduled that. And Russ is going to do a little mini series with us on rural electrification and programs in Kenya and other parts of Africa, which would be great.
Awesome. So this trend continues very much. So on to Sweden. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's kind of neat. I worked for the Energy Coalition, as you know, after I worked for Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. And the Energy Coalition was based in California, still is. But John Phillips, its founder, was married to a Swede. And so John had all the reasons in the world to go to Sweden. And what he formed was, and with the nonprofit Energy Coalition, he formed this exchange. And we took all sorts of utility officials from California, and city leaders, notably from Irvine and Santa Monica. And we took them to Sweden. We took them to Stockholm. We took them to Malmo. We took them to Gothenburg and vice versa. And so for four summers, I had the great opportunity to go to Sweden each time with these exchanges. And then all year long, we'd have these exchanges. But there was a couple of things I wanted to point out. We ran our student education program, the PEAK program, which is still in operation run by the Energy Coalition. So we ran that in Sweden, and the teachers had a great time and students had a great time relating back and forth from Sweden to California. There was all this student exchange and trying to find the similarities between us, amongst us, and also the differences between us. So that was one thing that was kind of cool, was this whole student exchange. But I was the Swedes in particular, and much of Northern Europe, you just have to admire their district heating systems. I mean, first off, it's really, really cold. So you have to get the heating together. But in Sweden, there's just incredible district heating systems that, as you know, that are supplying hot water throughout the city very, very efficiently. And so that was something that, you know, the U.S. policymakers, We have very little district heating in the United States, and there's also opportunities for district cooling, as we've talked about as well. The other thing that was really interesting that we studied in Gothenburg Energy, a municipal utility there, was that they were experimenting with comfort-based rates. So what is that? Instead of paying for kilowatt hours, you would subscribe, almost like a cell phone plan, or you would subscribe for comfort. So during the winter months, you want your home to be at 21 degrees C or whatever it is, 74 degrees Fahrenheit, you know, during the day, and at night, you're willing to go down to, you know, into the 60s. And the summer, you want this comfort. And they had all these different packages of comfort that you could buy from utility. And then you're paying every month for that level of comfort, right? This is known as end use pricing. You're paying for your comfort instead of for your kilowatt hours or for your therms of natural gas. Very, very interesting, right? Because if you think about it, if the utility go into homes and add more insulation and put in better windows and put in all sorts of efficient devices. So it gives the utility, it's a much more sophisticated utility model. Instead of, again, just selling a single commodity, kilowatt hours or therms of natural gas, you're wrapping around this comfort in a way that is very complicated and the utility has lots of different means of saving money. So it's pretty cool stuff.
So are these comfort-based rates, is this still something that's happening in Sweden?
I don't think so. Those rates, if you think about the evolution of them, originally lighting services, the French, the illuministes, you know, these companies that would provide lighting in cities, and they were charging by the foot candle of light. They weren't charging by the kilowatt hour. That's pretty good, because then if the light fixture becomes more efficient, they make a bigger profit. So it really advances the technology. But it's something for us to consider in the future. Again, I just love this notion that the utility could elect to put more insulation in your roof or help you put in better doors you know, to keep their profitability and to make everybody, it's a real win-win situation. So those were, there was a lots of fun times in Sweden and walking through the district heating tunnels and toasting. And of course, all of these trips were laced with alcohol and with all sorts of bonding. But I really think that, as I've said before, there's just tremendous value in getting out and seeing other countries and seeing other ways of doing business.
Totally. And what incredible learning. And speaking of, let's fast forward to your German solar project or tour. If you could ground us in the year and sort of the context of the why and the who and and why is Germany such a leader in solar for not having too much sunlight?
Yeah, it has about the same insolation, the amount of sunlight coming in as I think Fairbanks, Alaska. So, you know, Germany is not a logical leader in the solar world. But yes, in 2000, I think in 2005, the German government introduced a feed-in tariff, which was the most lucrative feed-in tariff, I think, ever that it's been ever implemented. And so what that means is, and unlike net energy metered systems where you're generating, you're using power in your own house and you're selling a little bit of export to the grid, and then you're buying a little bit from the grid. In a feed-in tariff, you're just selling kilowatt hours to the grid, right? It has nothing to do with your own load. And the Germans were offering 60 cents per kilowatt hour for 20 years, right? So that was just crazy high. And what happened was pig farmers were putting, you know, solar panels on their roofs and facades of buildings were getting done up with solar modules. And you just had an explosion in Germany. Right? Just an explosion. Factories were being built there and lots of technology was put into place. So we decided, I was working for the city of Santa Monica, or it was one of our clients, and we were a party to the proceedings at the California Public Utilities Commission, and we were promoting a feed-in tariff for California. We already actually had one, but it was paying just a pittance. Nobody was participating because we saw in Germany what happened when you put a really big number out there, everybody comes running. And so we were trying to do that. So we took in California, a group over, I think it was about 10 of us that went to Germany to witness what was happening and to document what was happening. We started in Berlin and met with policymakers. We stayed at a colorful hotel that in what had been East Berlin. We were all over the city, touring the city and Brandenburg Gates and on the river, looking at solar arrays. We had an extensive tour where there was a solar array in the rooftop of one of the Bahnhofs, one of the train stations that we checked out. We went to a brand new solar module manufacturing facility out near the Polish border in a town called Frankfurt Oder. There was a Conergy module manufacturing. And Johnny Weiss, who was the one of the founders of Solar Energy International, was with us on the tour. He was just blown away to see solar at that scale. Then we went to a town called Leipzig, which is going a little bit south from Berlin, where we went to the world's largest solar array, a 40 megawatt array, and called Wald Polenz. And we were just blown away. At that time, again, 2007, you know, there were no large arrays. This 40 megawatt array was the largest array in the world. And wow. There we were. And we were blown away that the guy that gave us the tour said, you know, we're actually generating power from moonlight. Because the array is so big that the moonlight was in aggregate was creating this effect. We went to Munich for Oktoberfest, which I think everybody's favorite day on the tour, is we were running pretty hard, you know, from town to town, from institute and installation to one another. We went through Stuttgart and some research labs. We ended up in Freiburg, which is probably Germany's number one environmental city. Mm-hmm. And Weber, who's at the Fraunhofer Institute, hosted us there. And it's a fantastic institute that does lots of work with solar. Perhaps it's Germany's greenest. I mean, there's a solar house that's a round house that actually spins around following the sun. Experimental house. It was just all sorts of fascinating demonstrations going on there. And we stayed in the greenest hotel, and they had its own solar system, and there was monitors in the lobby. None of that stuff seems particularly cutting edge now, but at the time, you know, that was pretty good stuff. So that was sort of the genesis of the German tour, was just this fascination with the feed-in tariff, right, that we wanted in California. And then the next year, I'll let you ask a few questions, but the next year, you know, Spain introduced a feed-in tariff, and it was nowhere near as lucrative. I think it was half the price, maybe 30 cents or 35 cents, but Spain has twice the sunshine. And so we went there and oh my God, Spain was just going crazy with solar at the time. It was very exciting.
Well, just, I guess one question on the Germany front, obviously there've been the leader in a lot of ways in solar and kind of at the cutting edge. Have they been able to maintain this competitive edge? And then from your vantage point, what was it? What were the ingredients that led to Germany leading the way, even without an incredible amount of sunlight?
Right. Well, you know, you've got a very, very strong environmental movement in Germany, an anti-nuclear movement in Germany, and it was trying to shut down all the nuclear plants. And, you know, this was one aspect of that, you know, major policy debate was solar and the feed-in tariff. And I think the takeaway from even the Germans was that it was too rich. It was, you know, they paid too much. And it ended up just sort of a free for all. And I think they've sort of tempered that approach. And a lot of countries now, Italy's had a feed-in tariff. You know, Japan has had a feed-in tariff. I think a lot of countries have really learned from Germany. Germany was the solar leader. I don't know who's the solar leader now. You know, it's probably China. But Germany, I think if you really did a major sort of macroeconomic analysis of what happened there, you'd find that all sorts of institutes were developed there and all sorts of manufacturing was developed there and all sorts of innovation. And so I think there was tremendous, you know, economic development in the clean energy space. And we've reported on this in the newsletter. You know, Germany has had periods of time now where 100% of the grid is being powered by renewables. You know, it's wind, it's solar. I think that Germany first had that about 4 or 5 years ago. It's just happened in California in the past year or two, right? We've had instances, you know, on those particular days when the wind is really blowing and it's really sunny and there's not that much demand on the grid where renewables are 100%. So Germany, I think, deserves to be credited for being way out front and stimulating this market that now it's gone global.
Right. And also you're saying there is some kind of happy medium in terms of the policy interacting with the market so that it can be sustainable.
Yeah, that's right. I think now that I'm sure they've ratcheted the price way down. It's just like we've done here. We have degressive, instead of incentives that go up, you have degressive rates or degressive incentives so that, you know, the early adopters get the really sweet rates, but they're the only ones that take the risk. And then gradually over time, you've transformed the market.
And so I'm hearing the kind of political, cultural, intellectual advancements that made this so, but how on earth did the utilities go for it?
It was a federal law. I can't remember the name of it. I think it was in 2004. It was a law and they were just told, thou shalt do this, right? So that's what happens. And you know, utilities incurred costs and they were probably allowed to rate base their costs. I mean, when you look at how utilities have operated all over the world, you know, anytime they build a new asset, you know, that goes into the rate base, that becomes and they're recovering that money. So I'm sure the utilities were not happy about it, but I'm sure they were also made whole. Now I think things have sort of tempered a bit.
Makes sense. So then it wasn't on this same trip that you ventured to Spain, was it?
No, it was the next year. We were getting a little cocky. You know, hey, we can be sitting in our office in Laguna Beach, or I guess it was in Irvine at the time, and take a group of Californians to Germany and see all the latest and the greatest. So we did that very successfully. Tiffany Tay was really instrumental. My brother Russell Flanagan was, you know, it was our tour guide the whole time, both of these trips. And we decided to go to Spain. Again, the Spaniards had introduced this, what we thought was an even better feed-in tariff because it was not quite as rich, but it was also really moving the market. And we thought, let's go check that out. At that time, we had officials from Palm Desert with us, which was really great. We were consulting for Palm Desert and doing climate action planning there. So it was great for them to see, hey, if there were an explosion, if there were a new policy in solar, look at the kind of explosive growth that can be had. And Spain was a whole lot more like Palm Desert in terms of climate than Germany. But I, we arrive in Madrid, and the day before, I'm getting together with Pepe Hurtado, who I'd worked with in the Philippines, him and his family. And Terry and I were going to that, I can't remember that famous museum in Madrid. Everybody's going to kill me for not remembering that. But we couldn't get across the street because there were so many bicycles. This is a wall of bicycles going by on one of these major avenues. And we just couldn't get across. And I thought, what the heck is it? And of course, it was Ciclovia, which now we've had in Los Angeles probably over 30 times, and city streets are shut down and everybody's out enjoying streets as public parks. So that was a great intro to our Spanish trip. But then the flip side of it is, again, we were feeling pretty cocky about our tour organizing. We had a dinner planned in Madrid off one of these great squares, and it was a really fancy place, and we were all excited about it. And we arrived there and the restaurant was shut down. And there we were, this tour group that didn't know anything about anything. Thank God that Pepe was there, my friend Pepe, who quickly took us to another restaurant. We had a huge time. But in Spain, we visited the University of Madrid solar facility. We were at Union Fenosa, which is the big utility there, and looking at how they were structuring their policies. We went by train. But by the way, the German trip and the Spanish trip were by trains almost exclusively, which was really fun. But we went down to Sanlúcar de Mayor, which was a town near Seville or Sevilla. And there was Abengoa's solar facility. And we were in a bus coming up from our hotel to this facility, is a research facility. And just above where this facility was, we just saw this halo of light and didn't have any idea what was going on. And what they had there was the first one of these concentrating thermal solar systems, right? Just like the one that's on the way to Las Vegas. And they have all these mirrors that are computer controlled, and they're shining light up to a central receiving station. And then it becomes really like a thermal power plant because it's boiling a liquid and creating steam, pressure, and generating power. So it was amazing to see that. And the reason that there was that halo of light in the air above was that they were doing maintenance on the tower. So they took all the panels, and instead of having them direct the sunlight up to the receiving station, they were just sending it up in space to get it out of there so they could do the work. And that was really the precursor to that facility that everybody knows if you've driven from Los Angeles to Las Vegas, called Ivanpah, right on the California border there, where we have three of these huge facilities that they're quite interesting because they don't use a lot of polysilicon. They don't use solar cells. They're using mirrors instead to direct the sunlight. So that was a fascinating visit. We stayed in Seville, which I want to go back to. It's a university town, and it's just got a terrific feel. We went to Granada. We went to Valencia. I went to some off-grid houses in Valencia. We had the most amazing experience in Valencia with these crazy flooding rains that flooded the streets. And we literally, I'd never been in a car that was sort of floating on the streets and bobbing around. But Jim Ferguson, who was the mayor of Palm Desert at the time, he and I just bonded over our experience with some good soul at the restaurant who drove us through these torrential conditions. But that's all part of the experience, right? It's all part of the experience. And that tour ended up in Barcelona, where we were studying some very early battery systems. But it was great. Both of those were just fantastic tours. We had fantastic time. And, you know, I think we exhausted everybody because our agendas were packed. But we figured, hey, we're studying. We're going to learn a lot.
Yeah, let's do it again. Sounds great. Yeah. So we want to squeeze in one more trip before we wrap up today's podcast, even though we could really have a whole podcast on each one of these trips. Is there anything else from your Spain trip? Any other take-home points that you want to share before we jump over to Iceland?
No. I think that's great. Let's go to Iceland.
Yeah. So totally different climate, culture. What was the impetus? What was the context for this trip? And what did you learn?
Yeah. And well, it was interesting because I mentioned earlier that we were working for the city of Palm Desert, and doing climate action planning for the city of Palm Desert out in the Coachella Valley. And as you know, there's a lot of geothermal energy there. And so the city of Palm Desert, which is was very progressive on a lot of these issues, was thinking about developing geothermal as they had developed hydrogen bus systems out there. I mean, they're doing fantastic things. So again, the mayor, Jim Ferguson, and another council member, Buford Kreitz, had been with us in Sweden when I was at the Energy Coalition. And I had arranged for us to go on a tour of Iceland and to tour the geothermal facilities in Iceland, which we did. And I had made contact with a fellow named Magnus Johansson, who was with Icelandic America. And they had already developed, you know, extensively geothermal in Iceland. And now they were selling that technology all over the world, right? So big, big district heating systems. Some of them were geothermally powered, but they were the experts at this. So we had an amazing tour. And I'll just talk a little bit about this. It wasn't until 1977 that Iceland tapped its geothermal energy. And before that, it was all coal from Poland, oil from Venezuela and other places. And Iceland was a very dirty in terms of carbon. It was a very dirty country. And it's a very cold country. And there's not a lot of sunshine. And so it was very energy intensive and carbon intensive. And then and they knew there was lots of geothermal energy around. In fact, the Blue Lagoon, which is a tourist trap now, but it's the effluent of the geothermal system where you go and you soak in the hot springs. And there's all these silicon minerals and things that everybody is enhanced by. Yeah, it's the best place to go in Iceland. It's just outside of Reykjavik. But so in 1977, there was this big initiative to start to tap the geothermal. And, you know, that's kind of scary stuff in ways, right? A lot of it's big volcanoes over there. We've all seen this recently on the news. But they were able to tap. It's very corrosive, this stuff that comes out of these geothermal systems. But they started building cogen plants where they were generating electricity. And then they were also capturing the thermal energy. And one of the things that was most impressed by was that across over Hill and Dale, coming into Reykjavik, is this large pipe. And it's about 40 inches in diameter. And it's super insulated. We saw a cross-section of it. And it's bringing hot water from the geothermal plant after it's been used to generate electricity. And it's bringing that hot water into Reykjavik. And it's going to this massive facility with these big, huge tanks. And it's called the Jewel. This is where all the hot water comes to. And they built an educational center on the top of this huge facility. There's a geyser in it. Every school kid, every school child in Iceland goes there to understand about how they've tapped geothermal. And so they have something called the Lindahl diagram, where they take the geothermal energy. The highest temperature, highest pressure is used to create electricity. And then you start heating homes, and you keep coming down and down, and you put in snowmelt systems. They actually even have a beach called the Nautilus Beach that's just in the northern part of Reykjavik, which is, you know, it's heated water. The Atlantic is very cold, so it's at the very end of the geothermal system. There is so much geothermal electricity, geothermal energy and electricity as a result of it, that now they also are converting their cars to hydrogen fuel, right? So they're using excess electricity to create hydrogen fuel. So they've decarbonized their transportation sector as well. Amazing. Amazing example of a country. And I think it was Buckminster Fuller who looked all around the US and all around the world and said, hey, look, wherever you look in the world, there's an abundant renewable resource, right? In the northwest of the United States, it's hydropower, it's biomass. In the Midwest, it's wind and biomass. Southwest, it's solar. And everywhere you look in the world, bar none, there are energy resources that are renewable energy resources that are there to be tapped. And Iceland is just about the most powerful story of that, how a country in about 50 years could basically decarbonize.
Wow. It's so cool and so hopeful. All of these learnings from all these trips from rural electrification in the Philippines to these exchanges you did in Sweden and learning about the district heating and cooling, the comfort-based rates, to Germany's feed-in tariff, and this even generating electricity from the moonlight, from Spain and this concentrated solar system and Cyclovia and Iceland and the Blue Lagoon and this abundance of geothermal energy under the ground. We are rich in renewable resources. It's just a matter of tapping in, and wow, how much we can learn when we exchange learning and travel and broaden our horizons outside of our comfort zones. So a big thank you, Dad, for taking this trip with me down memory lane. So many fun memories. I wish we could rewind the clock and get back to all of these times and places, but lots more to look forward to. Before we close out, are there any final comments or thoughts you want to share with our listeners?
Well, again, thanks for doing these crash courses. They're fun. And I hope that these reflections have some relevance. I think they do. I think that it is, again, as you've said, it's so important to look outside of our own sphere of influence and to be part of this practice of creativity and to learn from others. And it was so gratifying. This is just we've talked about maybe half of the countries I've worked in, but in every country, you get such a feel for the people, and then you start to understand some of the politics and the economics and the resources. And it's just fascinating. And I encourage our listeners to get out there and to learn. It's fun going to countries with a mission, like to learn about energy, right? I mean, often we go as tourists and we're just sort of, cruising around eating and having a good time. But it's been fun having this very focused, trips. And we found wherever we go, we found hosts that are just eager to tell us their stories. And that's gratifying too. So it's been great stuff. Yeah,
that's definitely a take-home point from all of these conversations in this three-part series is, wherever you go, people are really nice and helpful and want to share. And thank you. So let's stay curious. And for our listeners, if you are taking a trip, be curious, figure out what the power situation is like, take a tour of the local facilities. There's so much learning that we have to do all around us.
Absolutely true. Thanks so much, Sierra.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.